Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, while we are a couple months past February at this point, I'm doing my best Bill Murray presentation, and we are living our own version of Groundhog Day by diving into another groundbreaking DOL fiduciary rule and unpacking where and how it will affect investment advisor and broker-dealer firms across the country. For those who haven't been following these developments, here's a little history on the DOL fiduciary rule. In 2016, under the Obama administration, the Labor Department finalized a rule known as the fiduciary rule that replaced the five-part test and broadened the definition of a person or entity taking on fiduciary responsibilities, meaning that the rule basically applied to virtually any recommendation to a retirement investor. Following a challenge from the business community, in 2018, a three-judge panel in the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in New Orleans vacated the rule in a 2-1 decision, saying that the department had exceeded its legal authority. And the judges in that case did not agree that there could be a fiduciary status established when there wasn't a relationship of trust and confidence between an advisor and client. The Trump administration decided not to appeal the decision, and the fiduciary rule essentially died on the vine. In mid-2020, the Labor Department under the Trump administration announced a final rule reinstating the five-part test, and then a year later, the DOL finalized a prohibited transaction exemption that permitted investment advice fiduciaries to receive compensation for more types of guidance, including advice to roll over assets from a retirement plan to an IRA. Finally, October 31st of 2023, the department unveiled its retirement security rule proposal and prohibited transaction amendments. And on April 23rd, 2024, the DOL finally released its new fiduciary rule. Given the importance and impact of this topic, we're structuring today's show as another installment of our Lessons from the Frontline series. We've talked about these shows before, but for some of our new listeners, the Lessons from the Frontline series focus on real life, tough to tackle subjects that other industry professionals and regulators are facing on the front lines of our industry. And if you're anything like me, you may be suffering through a little bit of PTSD every time you see another DOL fiduciary rule come out. So to help alleviate you of some of that potential stress, we brought in one of the most renowned experts in this space, Mr. Fred Riesch, to help break down the new rule and arm you with some key questions and items to consider as you assess the overall impact to your firm and how to implement these changes in your firm's compliance program. I know the best thing for me to do at this point is to get up and out of the way. And so without further ado, Mr. Fred Riesch. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am incredibly pleased to welcome in for the first time, Mr. Fred Riesch, to talk to us about a upcoming new rule change with the Department of Labor fiduciary rule and talk more broadly about some of the evolving standards of care we have out there for registered investment advisors and other folks in the investment management space as it relates to any of the broker-dealer or investment advisor, Reg BI, application of rules, advisors, Act, et cetera. There is an evolving standard of care here that I think would be great to dive into. And who better than to bring in Mr. Fred Riesch to talk about it? Fred is a noted authority on retirement plan products and plan management and helps ensure that his clients help fulfill their fiduciary duty to investors and comply with federal law. He counsels plan sponsors, service providers, and other registered investment advisors on fiduciary responsibility, prohibited transactions under federal law, and other areas kind of related to the plan industry in general. Fred is a graduate of Arizona State University and got his JD from the University of Arizona and currently practices in California. Fred, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's really a great pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Patrick, thank you very much. Hello, everybody, from me as well. And it's great to be with you. The changes we're going to talk about, Patrick, are very big, then it's really important that people get at least a basic understanding of them right away.
Yeah, no, thank you. This really worked out from a timing perspective. We had planned to talk about, you know, the evolving standards of care that are out there in the investment management space. And as luck would have it, just, you know, within the last, you know, 48 hours, 72 hours or so, we've had some of these new rules from the Department of Labor come out. So, again, fantastic timing, and we're really excited to dive into the topic. As we kind of think about moving into the conversation proper here, Fred, I think it might be good for us to kind of set the table a little bit. And we alluded to it a little bit there in the intro. But, you know, it's interesting because if you are an investment advisor in this space, and I guess especially, you know, for some of those investment advisors that also might be dual registrants or have certain tie-ins to, you know, the broker-dealer space, they're really all a lot of shifting sands and evolving standards of care that you need to deal with when you think about the delivery of services that you're ultimately going to be providing many of those persons that you would consider your clients, right? And so I thought maybe at the start, if you're okay with it, we might talk a little bit about some of those evolving standards of care. You know, the last few years, especially, you know, going back to, say, 2019, when we had kind of the big Reg BI release and then the associated standards of care release for investment advisors, there's been a lot of conversation around this topic. So maybe a little bit of your broad interpretation of some of those standards of care that are out there, right? You've got kind of some of these different standards and what they mean and a little bit of how they compare to each other. And when I mean these standards of care, what I'm mainly talking about is kind of Reg BI and then the Advisors Act. And then maybe we'll dive into a little bit what's happening here on the Department of Labor side.
Sure. Well, you know, Patrick, you could even throw in the NAIC Model Rule 275 for annuity recommendations. It's also called the best interest rule. And what's happened, I think, is that as the financial world has become increasingly more complex, as participants accumulate retirement money in 401k plans that they ultimately roll over to IRAs, there's a realization by the regulators that, you know, we live in a, particularly for financial services and investments, we live in a very complicated world because we want to permit a lot of freedom. The complexity in many cases will be too great for the average person to really get to fully appreciate and to make informed decisions about. So 2019, the SEC proposed regulation best interest, which has since been finalized, and the interpretation for investment advisors that you mentioned. And if you look at both of those, I think Reg BI for broker-dealers is actually a tougher standard. I know that's going to surprise some investment advisors to hear that. But and part of that's because the interpretation for investment advisors is really principles, truly principles-based. And, you know, the fiduciary standard of care. The SEC said the duty of care and the duty of loyalty for investment advisors together is a best interest standard of care, but very principles-based. If you get into Reg BI, the standard of care is principles-based, but then there are a bunch of, like, rules-based parts to Reg BI. So it's, if for no other reason, just the volume of rules alone under Reg BI make it a more complicated and more demanding set of requirements. One example, investment advisors have to manage conflicts of interest, which can primarily be done through disclosure, where broker-dealers have to both disclose conflicts of interest and mitigate them. Now, that is a more demanding standard, but you might say it's deserved because there's so many different arrangements, so many different ways of being compensated at a broker-dealer that, and many of them are incentive-based, and so they do need to be mitigated. So I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm just saying they're a little bit different, but they both, if people are paying attention, they're both statements by the SEC that their expectations are increasing. That we're not, it's not your grandfather's SEC. It is a new, more demanding SEC, not based on anything other than changing times and changing circumstances. So, yeah, we're in a process, and the process isn't over yet. People need to be thinking about what's going on in the regulators' minds that's causing them to write these new rules and to be prepared for changes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point. And I certainly, what I like about how you articulated it there is the fact that some of that probably isn't intuitive, because I do agree with you that on its face, I think there are probably many people, many listeners to this show, in fact, that would probably think that the advisor's fiduciary duty is, you know, quote unquote, tougher or a higher level or whatever else. But you just mentioned it, and I think it's important. You know, we when we talk to clients and other folks and focus on, you know, running compliance programs, and you think about that, disclosure is as close to a panacea as you can get in the advisory world. It really is. And so that's just, you know, to your point, disclosure in the broker dealer world, and in a lot of ways now under Reg BI, that's not enough, right? You've got to actually show in many circumstances where you tried to mitigate or eliminate those conflicts of interest in those other areas. And so I think that's a really important point. I'm glad you mentioned that. Do you see, when you think about some of those disclosures that might need to be, you know, provided from the Advisors Act side of the house, or I suppose from the Reg BI too, but do you see there being kind of an evolution where those types of disclosures might need to become more individualized over time? And again, that might present some challenges for firms trying to comply with either one of those standards of care?
Yes, I do. You know, Patrick, again, I think we're on a timeline here. And if you go back just a year or two, that timeline was the SEC saying that it's not adequate to disclose you may have a conflict. If you do have a conflict, you have to disclose that you do. And, you know, while that may not apply to, that conflict may only apply to a limited number of your clients, you still have to disclose to them. Well, I think with technology, if we fast forward a few years, we are going to see more individualized disclosures. Why? Because we can. This is, in a sense, technology going all the way back to the first word processing machines has been making us more and more demanding. And going forward, it's going to get even more demanding, but the technology will be there to support it. I think my concern, you know, that with investment advisors being regulated in a principles-based setting, and then you hear people say, oh, goodness, the DOL or the SEC or FINRA is doing regulation by enforcement. What I think they don't appreciate is if you're under a principles-based regime, then when circumstances change, the application of those principles can change. And then the SEC or the Department of Labor comes in, investigates or examines, and says, you didn't do the right thing. And you go, wait a second, there's no rule that says that. Well, that's the whole essence of a principles-based regime for conduct. And I think that people need to appreciate that we're in fairly fast-changing times. If you don't believe me, think about artificial intelligence and what that's going to mean over the next few years. All of this, everything we do, everything investment advisors do, they're going to have to look at, gee, how does this comply with the rules as I know them today? I call that putting it under the microscope. And how does that comply with what rules are going to be, how this is going to get applied to changing circumstances, because the regulators come in 2 or 3 years later. They don't come in today. They've got 2 or 3 years experience with change before they even come in to look at you today. And so I call that the periscope, like a submarine periscope, looking out at the horizon saying, what's coming down the line? And I do think more individualized and probably more effective disclosure in order to obtain the benefit of informed consent is going to be required. So keep your eye on that one.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. And I think that starts to get into, as we look out across the horizon, right, and look into what's likely going to be changing here for many firms in the investment management space, to really go to what I anticipate will be the real entree of our conversation today, and talking about the new Department of Labor's, you know, fiduciary rule and rollover exemption and other related provisions that just recently came out. And, you know, I think, again, maybe, you know, before we even start to dive into some of the different parts of the new rule kind of proper, more formally, maybe can you talk to us a little bit about kind of what's the status and kind of like what's changing, right, with this new rule release?
Sure. The question is, are you a fiduciary for a retirement plan, a participant in a retirement plan, or an IRA owner? So it's, those are called retirement investors by the Department of Labor. Historically, there's what to be a fiduciary, you had to satisfy what's called the five-part test. I don't think it'll be any surprise to anybody that test has five parts. But only one really mattered, Patrick, and that was the requirement that advice be provided on a regular basis. And obviously, regular basis means more than once, and it probably means more than episodic. It means, you know, periodic. So the thing that's changing is that regular basis test is going away. One-time advice under the new rules can be fiduciary advice. And one-time advice provided by an investment advisor almost and certainly will be fiduciary advice, because the definition says it has to be individualized. But of course, that's what investment advisors do. They provide individualized advice. It has to be based on professional judgment. Well, gee, that's what investment, and so on. So one-time advice beginning on the effective date of these rules will be fiduciary advice if it's to a retirement investor. And while that may not seem like much to the listener, think about a rollover recommendation or an IRA transfer recommendation. That is typically one-time advice. I recommend you roll over, one-time advice to the plan. I'm never, ever going to give advice to that retirement plan again, but the rollover. And then there's a conflict of interest, of course, because if the participant rolls over, I make money off the account. If the participant doesn't roll over, I don't make anything. So you've got a combination of a fiduciary, new fiduciary, much more expansive fiduciary definition, together with the impact of conflicts of interest on these rules.
Yeah, no, thank you for adding that. And that is helpful for us to be thinking about, again, just to kind of start to frame the issue. I guess one of the things that I would be most kind of interested in hearing from you on is, you know, let's dive into this new rule and really start to get into some of the nitty gritty details of it here. You know, as you're looking at the new rule, who is affected? I think maybe might be a good place to start of who is this new rule going to impact? And are there, I guess, kind of a 1A, 1B, who does the new rule impact? And are there persons or other firms, investment managers in the space right now that are not currently regulated by the DOL that under the new rule would be regulated by the Department of Labor?
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to do that. Big picture, the rule is designed to impact four different types of advisors and product providers: investment advisors, registered investment advisors, broker dealers, banks and trust companies, and insurance companies. That's the target market. Turning to investment advisors, the DOL breaks investment advisors into two categories for reasons I'll explain in a second. The DOL looks very, very differently at discretionary investment management than it does at non-discretionary investment advice. Because from the DOL's perspective, when you make a non-discretionary recommendation to a retirement investor, nothing happens until they accept it. So there's something in between the recommendation and the implementation. With discretion, the advisor just manages. Now, why do I go into that? Because the exemptions for these conflicts of interest, the exceptions for these conflicts of interest, only apply to non-discretionary investment recommendations. If an advisor managing a retirement account has discretion, there are very few exceptions. Almost all conflicts of interest are prohibited, period. And there are very few exemptions. So what we're going to talk about today is non-discretionary investment advice by investment advisors. So within that investment advisor group, who's going to be impacted? Well, if advisors focus on retirement plans and they give pure level fee advice, I'm going to advise your plan on the selection of a mutual fund lineup for your 401k plan. I charge 50 basis points a year for that. I don't have any conflicts of interest. I don't get any money from custodians, anything from mutual funds or other investments or service providers. I'm just a pure level fee advisor. I don't recommend rollovers. I'm just pure level fee advisor for the plan. That person's going to be very lightly impacted. Maybe not really at all. I don't think they're going to have to change much of anything. No, so that's the least impact. Now, who's the most impact? Probably wealth managers who don't see themselves as being in the retirement plan market and who don't see themselves as being subject to DOL regulation. Why do I say that? Well, those wealth managers, and I've represented a number of them in dealing with similar rules previously from the Department of Labor, typically don't see themselves as being regulated by the Department of Labor, and they don't realize when they make a rollover recommendation to a participant in a plan, that is, they are then regulated. Or when they make a recommendation that somebody transfer their IRA from another firm to the advisor's firm, that is regulated by the Department of Labor. And not just lightly. There are some very specific steps that are somewhat demanding that they have to go through to make that recommendation. So what's in between? Well, you know, I think the if you're providing pure level fee advice to an IRA, that's similar to a plan. You're not recommending transfers. You're not recommending that money, the rollovers from plans. But I'm really mostly concerned about wealth managers who don't realize they're regulated by the Department of Labor. That's where I think that's going to be the heaviest lift for compliance with these new rules.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there, and it might be good timing to talk about a couple of the steps or kind of requirements that they would need to comply with in order to make that recommendation, right? You mentioned that some of those wealth managers would likely have to follow certain steps, kind of very, you know, prescriptive or specific steps in order to be able to make that recommendation that is, you know, conflicted when you're making, when you're recommending that someone roll over, you know, a 401k into an IRA. What are some of those steps? What are some of those disclosures or other items that you would need to provide in that instance?
Sure. Well, there's four categories of requirements, and I'll list them generally first. I'll make some comments, and I'll get to your specific question. Number one, the advisor has to satisfy the impartial conduct standards. Well, what's impartial conduct standards? That's a label from the Department of Labor. It has meaning, though. You have to act with a duty of care, sort of thing of a fiduciary duty, and a duty of loyalty, similarly, a fiduciary duty. You can't put your interest ahead of the investors. No more than reasonable compensation relative to the services provided, no materially misleading statements. There are a group of things like that that are called the impartial conduct standards. Secondly, there's a whole series of disclosures that have to be made, one of which is saying, in making this recommendation to you, I, the advisor, am a fiduciary under ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code. That's a written disclosure that has to be made. I'm going to come back to rollovers in a minute, but you have to describe your services. You have to describe your conflicts. Yeah. When I've helped advisors with this in the past, I've found that their combination of their advisory agreement, their form CRS, and their ADV, usually, not always, but usually have the conflicts and the services disclosures done in an adequate manner. But there are that series of disclosures. Category three is policies and procedures. The firm has to have policies and procedures reasonably designed to ensure compliance with all these rules. Number four is an annual retrospective review. Every year, after the end of a year, within 6 months, the advisory firm has to conduct an audit, a sampling, statistically valid sampling of the covered recommendations in the preceding year, reduce that to writing, and have it signed by a senior executive officer of the advisory firm. When you're talking to an advisory firm or a dual registrant with hundreds of advisors, that makes sense. When I've talked to small firms with one or two or three advisors, you know, they say, what are we going to, you know, that's a lot of work. And all the only thing we can do is review each other's recommendations. It seems sort of silly. And it does. But it's a rule. And they would have to comply with it. So those are the four categories: impartial conduct standards, disclosures, policies and procedures, and annual retrospective review. Going back to your specific question about a rollover, there is, whenever a rollover recommendation from a plan to an IRA is made, there is a specific disclosure that's required. And to summarize the disclosure, the advisor has to reduce to writing why the rollover recommendation is in the best interest of the participant and give that writing to the participant. So there is a written record. And, you know, and work I've done on this in the past, some advisors want to put in things like, well, because the participant wants to work with me, or because I have lots and lots of investment options available, and the plan only has 20. I mean, all kinds of reasons like that may not withstand the test of time. keeping in mind that the DOL or the SEC, since this involves policies and procedures, will come in 2 or 3 years later. And you said, gee, we have all these additional investment options available. And you look, and the participant in the IRA, all over IRA, is just invested in mutual funds or ETFs. It's like, wait a second. That may have been a good reason generally, but the reasons have to be specific to that particular participant. What are you going to do for that participant? You know, we talked about individualization earlier. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do for that participant that's going to make their life better in terms of their retirement money? And there's an art form to developing that. And part of that art form is understanding what the DOL is after.
Right. I think there are a couple. Thank you for that outline and for that additional context. I think that is really, really helpful to frame it. And I do agree generally that I think there are many investment managers out there that think, again, they're thinking about, well, why am I providing this recommendation? Well, again, to your point, in a very generic way, well, we have a lot more options available for them. And it's like, well, no, that's not exactly how this works, right? Because we're talking about a rollover recommendation for this specific client. And so if ultimately, right, we need to think about, okay, why is it in the best interest of this specific client because of their unique situation that they might be able to then better leverage some of those investment options that you were just articulating that might be not necessarily available if they stuck with their 401k.
Yeah, exactly. Like for a $1 million rollover, maybe hedge funds, private equity funds, things like that might make some sense. For a $250,000 rollover, you know, maybe not. And incidentally, the SEC has said as much also in the adopting release to regulation best interest. The SEC said just having a lot of investment options in and of itself is not a good reason. It has to matter to that person. And then the SEC staff picked that up in their account type staff bulletin of a year or two ago.
Yeah. So
there's now a fair amount of authority out there saying you have to have reasons that matter to that person.
And, you know, another thing I'll mention and would love to get your feedback on specifically as it relates to, again, kind of satisfying some of these specific steps. And again, thank you for laying out that list. I know for a lot of the legal and compliance nerds that listen to this podcast, that's super useful about, you know, satisfying the impartial conduct standards. We're going to make sure to provide relevant disclosures, have policies and procedures to back them up, and then do that, you know, annual retrospective review. So that's super helpful. When you're thinking about providing those disclosures and, you know, what we would want to have available, right, if we were to get examined by the SEC or I guess potentially the DOL for compliance with that, would you generally recommend, Fred, that you know, when we're providing those disclosures to the client or prospective client who might be getting the rollover recommendation, that we're documenting that we're providing it? And oftentimes, would you also say it's good to have the client or prospective client acknowledge that they've received those? Are we, you know, saving that documentation? What would be some thoughts around that part of the process?
I've developed those forms for a number of investment advisory firms and dual registrant broker dealers. My experience is that when I'm working with the compliance officers, particularly, they do want something signed. And the bigger the firm, the more likely they want something signed, because they, you know, if you just have 3 or 4 advisors in a firm, they can all sit down together and talk about how they're going to comply with these rules. And they're probably pretty sophisticated people. Even there, as a lawyer, I'd like to see something signed. But I'm more comfortable with that scenario without something signed, because they can really work with each other to understand the rules and comply with them. But if you're a CCO for 500, 1,000 advisors, I assume there's a pretty high level of discomfort, you know, and because right, not every one of them, some of them may be motivated to try to get the business even more than to make a good recommendation. And so you want documentation, hopefully signed by the advisor, not just the participant or the investor, the advisor right, and the investor. And so most of the forms I prepared are done that way, Patrick, where it's signed by the advisor and by the investor.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And to your point, right? I mean, for some of those folks that might be at a larger firm, right? We gotta kind of design policies and procedures that are gonna fit for everybody. And maybe I'll frame it as those that might be less compliance minded than others. Maybe when you're at a smaller shop and you can better control who's going to be kind of, you know, providing those different services. I think that makes a lot of sense. What about kind of educational stuff in general? You know, if I'm providing investment education or kind of, informational type pieces, or if I'm just even talking about it generally with a prospect or an existing client, is that something that would trigger an investment recommendation under the new rule, or how does that play out?
No, properly done, Patrick, it works. What we tend to do with our clients is we'll prepare like a brochure, a rollover brochure. Here are your four options. Leave the money in the plan. If you move to a new plan, move it over there. Take a taxable distribution, which no policymaker wants them to do, or roll it over to an IRA with me. I mean, those are like the four options. And here's the pro and cons of each. I, as your advisor, am glad to explain any of this to you, answer any questions. As long as it's substantially complete, it's factually correct, and it's not misleading, that works. That is, education is not considered to be a fiduciary recommendation when the education is properly done. In this case, though, I do really push my clients to have acknowledgments by the participants that they received education, that the advisor did not make a recommendation, and they made the decision on their own. And there's even a third category, Patrick, which is unsolicited. But in working with CCOs at different firms, CCOs seem to have a real dislike for unsolicited. So they said, many of them have said to me, "No, Fred, we're not going to do that. I know that's possible. We're not going to do it. We're going to make the advisor go through an education process, even where it is otherwise unsolicited, because it's too easy to check that box. And because we have to, we have to oversee these activities from afar. And so we're more comfortable doing it where there's an educational brochure and an acknowledgement by the investor."
That's super helpful. Thank you for help clarifying that exception. The one, other exception, or I guess part of the rule that I thought might be worth mentioning and would welcome your thoughts on, is, I know that, like, for instance, the Investment Advisor Association and some other comments to the kind of proposal requested an exception for certain institutional investors with regard to where that, advice that's provided to kind of plan fiduciaries. How did the final rule kind of shake out on that specific item?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of names for that: sophisticated investors, counterparties, wholesalers, but it comes down to the same thing. And under the proposal, but not under the final, under the proposal, if a wholesaler or a representative of a mutual fund family, an insurance company, an investment manager, made a recommendation to a fiduciary, an investment advisor that was, providing advice in turn to IRAs or retirement plans or participant accounts, and that would have made the wholesaler a fiduciary, the DOL removed that. They carved that out of the final rule. So wholesalers generally, it's still even possible for them to step over the line. For example, if they're in a meeting with a client, it's not a full wholesaler exception, but if they're advising only the investment advisor to the account or the plan, then they won't become a fiduciary, even if they get into some level of detail about who their product is particularly appropriate for. So that is welcome relief, because it's the wholesaler might not even know the client they're talking about, the advisor's client they're talking about. That was tough. That was a tough rule in the proposal, but it's gone.
Yeah. Well, glad to hear that we landed, I think, in a better spot there than was at least proposed under the kind of original part of that rule. Let's talk about something that I'm sure is on a lot of folks' minds that are listening to this podcast, which is, when am I going to have to comply with this? And what does the timing look like? Because I think Certainly, that's going to be a very sensitive topic. And it sounds like, at least from some of the preliminary stuff that I've seen, like things are moving quickly. So what are your thoughts there around the timing of this new rule, Fred?
I agree, Patrick. You know, people are going to spin around three times and it's going to be here because time goes by so fast. The fiduciary rule, the new definition of one-time advice, becomes effective on September 23, 2024. Basically, what the rule says is 150 days from the date that it's published in the Federal Register. It's published in the Federal Register on September 25th of this year. And that gets you out to September 23, 2024. So the fiduciary definition applies then. Now, the exemptions, if you have conflicts of interest, part of them applies September 23, 2024, and part September 23, 2025. So there's a year delay in part. What parts are which? The part that applies roughly 5 months from now is the impartial conduct standards, you know, the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, reasonable compensation, no materially misleading statements, that part applies then, same time as the new fiduciary definition. And the written disclosure to the participant or other retirement investor, you're acting as a fiduciary under the Internal Revenue Code and ERISA. A couple years ago, the DOL actually issued some sample language for that. And frankly, I would just use the sample language. I mean, they give it to you, why not? But that has to be provided in writing, more or less as a point of sale disclosure. You know, I would do it concurrent with the recommendation just to make sure it's done. So what's delayed? Those are the only parts that come in this year. What's delayed to 2025? The rest of the disclosures, including the rollover disclosure I mentioned, and the policies and procedures and the annual retrospective review. In other words, everything but the best interest, the impartial conduct standards, and the acknowledgement of fiduciary status. Other than that, it's all delayed. Doesn't mean you can't begin practicing that way. It just means you don't have to.
Right. Well, and that's, again, you know, you think about that, you just had the new rule hit the Federal Register on April 25th. You got now basically 150 days from April 25th. That's, again, September later this year. You're absolutely right. Turning around three times and it's here. And then on top of that, right, there's that immediate compliance with, again, as you just mentioned, the impartial conduct standards and the disclosures of the fiduciary status kind of under the rule. But then you've got all these other items that you're going to need to prep for.
Let me add one thing quickly here, that one of the requirements under the impartial conduct standards, the duty of care and the duty of loyalty, to make a rollover recommendation, you need three buckets of information and you need to do a comparative analysis. One is, what are the investments, services, and expenses in the plan? Two is the investor profile, like what are the needs and circumstances of this participant? Three is, what can I do for them in the IRA that's better than where they are in the plan? So, and you do a comparative analysis of how I think I could invest them in the IRA versus how they are in the plan in light of their needs and circumstances. And the DOL expects that comparative analysis. Now, that you don't have to document it and give the analysis to the participant until 2025, but you still have to do the analysis beginning this year. Raises a big question. What's your source of data? Where are you going to get information about the investment, services, and expenses in the plan? Now, if you're the advisor to the plan, you know all that. But if you're not the advisor to the plan, how do you get that information? And there are a couple of ways to do that, which maybe something for a future program, but.
Well, let's dive into it a little bit, because I do think, I'm glad that you mentioned that, Fred, because I think what you just, expounded upon there is one of the questions that I get asked the most, which is, I'm a wealth manager. I've got a prospect. They are really interested in rolling over their 401k. I've talked to them about the services that I can provide, and they are itching to sign up with me, right? Like, they're all about, you know, my advisory firm and what we can do to help them And one of the things they want to do is roll over their 401k into a brokerage account, an IRA brokerage account that I can manage. But darn it, I'm having the hardest time, right, getting any information that I need to help do that comparative analysis. And we hear this same kind of narrative a lot. When you have folks that are experiencing that on your side, what are some of the thoughts or ideas that you have for how they can try to mitigate that challenge that they're having there?
Sure, Patrick. One thing I want to mention, there's a little bit of a trap here. If the investment advisor says, if you come with me, I will invest you in the following way, and you actually lay out how you would invest them, the Department of Labor says that's an implied recommendation to roll over. You're now subject to our rules. And I understand that's a fairly common practice.
Right.
So be aware of that one, because you may unknowingly make a recommendation that makes this a covered transaction. Okay, back to your question. What the DOL expects is there's a thing called 404A5. That's the name of a regulation, but it requires a certain information be given to the participants initially and every year thereafter about the investment services and expenses in the plan. But when you say to a participant, give me your 404A5, they have no idea what you're talking about, because nobody in the real world calls it that. If it's called anything, it might be the investment chart or the comparative investment chart. If it's called anything on the website, because that's where it is. It is on the plan website. It's all there. If you go look at the investments that are available, there's a description of the service. Anyway, it's all there. But participants don't seem to understand that. The way the rules work, they say, if you ask for it and the participant says, I don't want to give it to you, or I don't know where it is, or I can't find it, and you say, well, it's on your website, print it off, give it to me. No, I don't want to do that. Then you can say, okay, now I can use alternative data, and that's a term of art, alternative data. But I have to admonish you that if I do that, the data I'm looking at is averages, and it may not properly reflect your plan, which could impact my recommendation. But if you won't give it to me, then I'm willing to do that. So then you need, the participant says, I just want to get this over with. Go look at your alternative data. So then you need a source of alternative data, because it doesn't just exist in the thin air.
Magically appear when you say, give me the alternative data, right? Yeah.
Those aren't like magical words. There's no Harry Potter aspect to that. So you gotta have a source. I represent at least one of the sources, but there are several out there. They're data companies, and they gather information about investments, services and expenses and plan. You subscribe to it, you pay a fee. Typically the firms do that, so that the advisors at that firm have access to it. But there are companies out there, and I would encourage you to do that, because the feedback I'm getting from the field with my other clients is that their advisors are having a heck of a time getting actual data. So they're tending to resort to alternative data as a more common way of doing it. But you have to give those admonishments that I mentioned. You can't just say, okay, I'll use alternative data. You have to say, you realize it may or may not be accurate because it's averages. So you have to admonish. Now, real world, is that actually a conversation? Maybe. But I think most people will put it in writing and have that as a disclosure document that's given to the participant.
Yeah.
So it works. I mean, it's a little hard, but it works.
So this will be the last question I'll ask on at least kind of that, portion of it. And then maybe we can start to round up with some other kind of key elements of the rule or other kind of considerations you think would be important for folks to think about and start to wrap up our conversation. But one, the other scenario that we hear or get all the time, even in light of the DOL fiduciary rule and again the continued counsel from legal practitioners and compliance professionals that we've got to do this comparative analysis right of the different investment recommendations out there, they will say some version of the following, right? They'll say, it's Saturday morning, I'm at my kid's soccer game. Okay, I get a call from client X who says, hey, great news, I just resigned from my job and to heck with those guys. I'm done with them. I'm so glad I'm out. I'm over the wall and I would really like to roll over. I don't want anything more to do with them ever again. So I want to roll over my 401k and I want to move it into into an IRA brokerage account with you. And because, you know, you, Mr. Advisor, are a dutiful, you know, compliance-oriented financial advisor, you say, well, Mr. Client, that's wonderful news. I'm so happy about your new gig and all this other stuff, but I need to talk to you about what options you might have. In addition to rolling it over, you could keep it in your 401k. And they might come back with, no, like I said, you know, to heck with them. I just want to go with you. And that's all. And so, you know, we get a question from advisors, you know, that will say, okay, well, in that scenario, if I can document and get the client to sign the fact that they are the ones that are doing that are really pushing this and requesting it, does that mitigate at all the need to do some of the comparative analysis? Is the need still there? You know, what are your thoughts in that kind of hypothetical?
That's what I called unsolicited earlier. And, you know, working with particularly advisory firms where maybe there's one office and maybe there's 3 or 5 or 10 advisors, you know, a manageable size where they can get together and talk about things. I do talk to them about the availability of the unsolicited approach, saying, and because I do think it happens on a regular basis, Patrick, I think that's the real world. But my approach, and if only all my clients did what I recommended, it would be a great world. But my approach is to say, look, I'm the most comfortable if you have an existing relationship with that person. Do you already manage money for them? Do you manage money for a family member? Do they have a family member that works at your firm? I mean, in other words, would that person that made that phone call that in your hypothetical, would that person have a reason for already knowing about your firm and knowing about the quality of your work, your expenses, and so on? I say, if somebody walks in off the street and says, hey, I got $1 million. Will you manage my rollover for me? I've never met you before in my whole life. I'm a little skeptical of that being unsolicited, Patrick.
Right.
So I want to see some connection. If there is a connection where, so I define it. I ask that it be defined. Yeah. You know, we will accept unsolicited rollovers from the following types of people. And right, then I'm okay with that. Now, for bigger firms where they're more skeptical, where the CCOs or the in-house counsel are more skeptical of unsolicited, or they feel like they can't be as much on the spot to manage the issues, then there they say, nope, we want you to put that guy through an educational approach regardless. Set them down, walk them through it, and then have them sign off on an educational acknowledgement. So it varies depending on the firm, the culture, the size, all kinds of things.
Yeah. No, look, that, Fred, thank you for kind of humoring me with that hypothetical there. But no, I really appreciate you talking through that. And I love the way that you laid out how, look, that even how you just articulated that response, it's really going to be a little bit of art and science. And a lot of that's going to be dependent on the size of your firm, the common denominator of your financial advisors and their ability and how they're, you know, connecting with clients on a frequent basis and their ability to document probably lots of things that might surround the advice and the other conversations they're having with clients. And so I think that's, you know, really, really helpful. Thank you for that.
Well, thanks.
The last question is, we think about kind of wrapping up our conversation today, that I would have for you is, you know, other than any of the items that we've talked about, you know, thus far with regard to the rule itself and, you know, whether it's some, you know, challenges, you know, with implementation, we've talked about impact to, you know, the subset of financial market participants and how that's going to happen. We talked about timing. You know, are there any additional comments on any of those items that you'd like to expand upon? Or is there anything else, you know, that you think would be really beneficial or helpful for our listeners to know as they're thinking about having to comply with this new rule?
Yeah, a couple of things, Patrick, not as important as some of the biggest things we've already talked about, but a couple of things people should be aware of. There are three categories of recommendations that are defined at some level of detail in the fiduciary rule. And there's some unexpected things in there, like a recommendation of an investment strategy. a recommendation of an investment policy. Those are fiduciary recommendations. Now, I don't see that those are particularly traps, but it means that you've got to engage in a prudent process to make those recommendations. One that could be a bit of a trap is if somebody has an IRA with your firm, and then the advisor says to the IRA owner, there's this great investment over here, but I think you should pull money out of your IRA and invest in it personally. That is a fiduciary recommendation. Mm-hmm. And you've got to engage in a prudent process. You have to go through the considerations of why it's in the best interest and so on. So I would recommend, I mean, that's too much detail to deal with on a program like this one. But what I think would be a good approach would be for folks to have, you know, with your securities attorney or an ERISA attorney, have like a 1-hour virtual meeting or phone call to go through the rules, to understand some of the stuff at that level of detail, because you don't want to get trapped by something you simply didn't know about when you're trying to do the right thing. So, yeah, but no, there are little things here and there, but I think we hit the big things, Patrick.
Brad, that is fantastic advice, and would certainly echo those thoughts. Thank you again so much for, you know, coming on today's show and going through what is a really nuanced, sophisticated topic, and I'm sure one that's going to be challenging for lots of listeners out there to comply with. This has been an excellent conversation, and thank you again. We typically like to end our show with maybe something a bit less technical, maybe a bit more fun. But don't worry, these aren't the hard hitting kind of questions that we've talked about already on the show. So, but maybe, you know, look, we're starting to get a little bit into spring here. Summer months are right around the corner. What's maybe one thing you're looking forward to as the warm summer months occur to get out and go do? Maybe is it traveling? Is it some other type of warm weather activity? What's one thing you're looking forward to doing here over the summertime?
Well, Patrick, I've already made the plans. I have a second home in Laguna Beach, California, which is a little slice of heaven.
Sure.
And I've got a home office down there. I'm going to spend the month of August in Laguna Beach, and I'm going to walk on the beach every day. And I'll still have to think about what we've been talking about, but I will have part of that day where all I'm thinking about is seawater and seagulls.
That sounds like a fantastic summer exercise, and I wish you very well in that endeavor. That sounds wonderful. As I'm likely in that same August time frame, I'm going to be dealing with a first grader and a pre-kindergartner screaming and yelling, getting ready for school. We're going to have slightly different existences at that point, but nonetheless, we will both be enjoying the month of August. So, Fred, thank you again so much for coming on the program today. It's really been a pleasure, and look forward to having you back on the podcast here at some point down the road.
Hey, Patrick, it's great. You're so much fun to be with. I've enjoyed it.
And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Mr. Fred Reich, for coming on the show today to share his fantastic insights on the new DOL fiduciary rule and how firms can best navigate the challenges associated with this difficult compliance area. Please join us again next time on Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.